devotees.
Joan Baez, with including the applause. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And my guests today are Eric M. Adams and Jordan Stanger Ross. And they've written a wonderful book, urgent book, I would call it, Challenging Exile, Japanese Canadians and the Wartime Constitution. Welcome to you both.
Really great to be
here. Is this book available now?
Happy to say that it is available now, officially available as of the middle of October, which means that people can buy it online at the UBC Press website, or U of T Press has a site as well for purchase of the book. And we've seen it in a number of bookstores around town, so Indigo and other independent bookstores. So we just encourage people, if they're interested in this story, to pick up a copy.
Well, it's as the introduction to the book lays out, to me, it's very true that here we are. Tomorrow is Remembrance Day, and people think of the two big ones, the one that was the war to end war, and the other to establish good things around the world, the United Nations, et cetera. And meanwhile, at the same time, we don't seem to remember when it always turns into Hero Day, and weren't they glorious, and it was all so worthwhile. And but all the damage done to civil society, to ordinary people who didn't have any particular involvement or didn't have the responsibility for the various crimes, et cetera, many of them was spread all over the earth and damaged. But that's never part of the speeches, as far as I know. And then south of the border, we have now the Donna Mar-a-Lago, who found out that if you say national security, you can erase people's rights, and people, actually. And while people are concerned, I don't see the appropriate alarm to this, but your book really affirms the importance of living by the law and the Constitution. So I want to, first of all, I want to talk about this part. You also frame it so well, because this says challenging exile. I have to say, I thought I knew something about this, and to a certain extent I do. I've been reading some books and papers, etc. But the narrative that we have about World War II in the United States and Canada is that we had, unfortunately, a tragic encounter with Japan and, of course, with fascists in Europe. And people who were identified as potentially supporters of Japan or Germany, to a degree Italy, they had to be kept apart from the community for a period of time. And that was bad, and we're ashamed of ourselves. And we thought about it, and we've also forgiven ourselves. But now everything's back to where it was. So when I read the headline, the title, and Challenging Exile, I said, what do you mean, exile? That chapter was, I guess I was slightly aware of it, but that in many ways is the ugliest part of it. First of all, I would ask you, what happened? Let's just, if you would, both of you can choose when you want to speak about it a bit. What did when was this decision made, first of all, to incarcerate Japanese Canadians, and why did they do it, and did they have to do it? Whomever.
Thanks, Phil. And I think, you know, a lot of your introduction that you've offered reflects how we've been thinking about this moment in the present day, and just thinking about what can be authorized under a sense of emergency, and people who can be trampled under those conditions, and how should we respond? And so the book, although we didn't start the book in that context, certainly we've thought about it a lot in recent months and years even. We started the book at the start of the first Trump administration. So a moment in history that I think our book tries to draw attention to is 80 years ago right now, so the fall of 1945. And it's right at this very moment that Canadian officials are trying to figure out what to do at the end of internment. And I know you asked about the beginning of internment, and we can talk about that too. But right at this moment in the fall of 45, the government's moving towards a proposed exile of Japanese Canadians to Japan as a way of ending the internment in Canada. And that's a kind of a shocking moment, and that's the exile that we refer to in our title, that Canadian officials came to see it as appropriate to end the mass internment of Japanese Canadians by sending as many as possible to Japan. And it's an interesting moment also where there are starting to be allies outside of the Japanese Canadian community in the fall of 45, and Japanese Canadian activists who are saying, hold on, what's going on? You know, what can be authorized under this sense of the license given to a wartime government?
Your book, you weave in very nicely Canadians, and many of them now very distinguished figures, Japanese Canadians, who have contributed so much, even though they went through that nightmare. But you followed their lives and what actually happened, and compare it to the rhetoric of our leaders. Their exile, in reality, it struck me on the what happened to them on the coast. It began immediately. Their homes were placed in Vancouver, Nanaimo, came to an end. And when your book outlines that they were given ugly choices about where they're going to live, but one place they were not going to live was home. Am I right?
I think that's exactly right. When Jordan and I wanted to focus the attention on a place that I think has fallen out of the history of this story, which is the end of things. And Phil, I think you captured the idea that in Canada, at least, there is a sense that an internment of Japanese Canadians took place. There's a sense that that happened. But built into that story is, I think, a narrative and perhaps even a justification that, well, in war, hard things happen. And what Jordan and I realized is that as much as Canadian history may have accounted in some ways for what began, there has never been a full accounting or even understanding of how this ended. And this ended not in moments of crisis. It did not end in wartime at all. It ended after the war had ended, when Canadian officials are, with very deliberate and sober reflection, saying the best way to end what they described as the Japanese problem was to remove as many Japanese Canadians from the country as possible. And this was a community of more than 22,000 people, the majority of whom had either become Canadian citizens or who had been born in Canada. The Japanese nationals that were in this community, most of them had lived in Canada for decades. And so this was an established, vibrant immigrant community. How could you understand the path to this decision in 1945 that a supposedly benign government would think that exiling people, stripping them of citizenship, destroying this community's connection to Canada was the viable policy alternative? What led them to this moment? And what Jordan and I try and create in this book is a sense of all of the little decisions that happened that took them to that moment. And it wasn't just a question of internment. It was internment followed by a decision to take property of Japanese Canadians. And that was followed by a decision to sell the property of Japanese Canadians. And that was followed by a decision to make sure that Japanese Canadians didn't return to their former homes in BC. Yeah. And how could all this happen?
There are echoes of what was going on in Europe, right, where it began, the treatment of Jews, for example, in Germany. They began with, well, just register. We'll give you a card.
Yeah.
We have to list your properties. And then at the end of the road was annihilation. I mean, it's so ugly you described it, incremental.
Yeah.
But also your book says, actually, there were choices. You have a second piece of writing on this called Wrongs and Choices. What is it? Bad?
Right. Past wrongs, future choices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be this way. I mean, wartime rationale is, and even as a child, I heard such things. Don't you know there's a war on?
Yeah.
And so if they say, don't you know there's a war on, what they then take over what the situation. But a rational war leader, or leaders, could have handled this. These are Japanese Canadians. They're Canadians. They're willing, and they're a healthy part of our community. That could have been made positive, but instead it was made and negative. And it is simply a race, is it not?
Mm. I wanted to touch. You mentioned the kind of you drew in that comparison to Europe and to the mass murder, obviously, of Jews in Europe. And one of the things that happens in the 1940s is a lot of discussion of what's happening in Europe. So Japanese Canadians are aware after 1944 of what's happening to Jews in Europe and even earlier. And officials are as well. And so are politicians. I mean, officials, bureaucrats are in crafting the laws, are conscious of Nazi law. And so are officials conscious of the Nazis as the enemy. And one of the ways in which I think it functions, so there's a lot of discussion of Nazis. And one of the ways in which it functions, I think, for government officials is to say, well, that's the maximal, in a sense, evil, right? Mm. So as long as we can understand ourselves as stopping short of that, I have a colleague in political science who uses a term maxing that he thinks it still happens, where you set up a kind of maximal evil, so the mass murder of people. And as long as the policy can be seen as not that, right, that establishes a threshold. Well, we're not that. So the prime minister is able in 1944 to get up and say, well, our policy where we'll expel disloyal Japanese Canadians and let the rest live in Canada, that's not the racial doctrine of our enemies. This is fair Canadian British law. And so that looming analogy plays various roles. It allows Japanese Canadians to challenge what the government's doing to them, say, hey, what is this, Nazi Germany? And eventually, as allies come on board, the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star papers are going to say, hey, we can't continue down this path. That's the root of fascism. That's the root of Nazis. But at the same time, it functions, I think, for government officials to say, well, if we strike this clause from this law that would prevent any challenge to the procedure, then we're not being Nazis. Or the prime minister can get up and say, well, because we're distinguishing loyal from disloyal. So a lot is licensed, in a sense, by that analogy.
The other thing that you know this historical work let us do was to go deep into the thousands, and I mean thousands, of government records that exist about these conversations internal to government about how these policies got made. And sometimes when we look back on such moments, it seems inevitable. That's the way our mind works and memory works, and sometimes that's the way history works, to just say, well, of course that was the path, and it was a more racist moment in history, and racist things happened during this racist moment. But when you look at the records, the records that aren't part of that narrative, what you see is that at virtually every moment, there are people in government voicing doubts about whether that was the correct path and, yeah. and voicing concerns about things like fairness, racial equality, fair treatment, that didn't seem very Canadian. and at the same time, there is a vibrant, you know, Japanese-Canadian generated record, their own newspaper, but also their own private letters and communications that Jordan and I were able to access through the archives, in which, of course, Japanese Canadians are saying vociferously, frequently, and really eloquently that none of this is fair treatment, that none of this accords with our constitutional rights.
There's a wonderful expression, equal treatment under the law.
Yeah.
And it was taken away.
Yeah.
And I thought a very important point, it probably is bandied around by historians, people understand, that you know, they say, well, you know, this happens with war. World War One, we brought in people from who were born under the Austro-Hungarian system, and we incarcerated them in World War Two, and it's really unfortunate. We ought to be careful. But no. Your book points out that's not accurate. Every Japanese, 10 years old, 16-year-old, 90, is an enemy. That's not the same thing as saying, "Oh, there are some of these people like Tojo, or there's some of these people like Hitler." No. This is Japanese.
Well, one of the questions we get a lot, and it's understandable, is, "Well, you know, what didn't Canada do something a bit similar to German Canadians and Italian Canadians?" And there are some overlaps, but only on the smallest of scales. So you're right that there were.
And you give the numbers. 8% was it of they describe them as Ukrainians, which would, by the way, include Poles, Jews, and Russians under the Austrians.
Yeah. So there's
8%.
It's true that there were you know in the hundreds of persons that were interned. Some of them probably unfairly. There was suspicion that took over good sense in those internments. The Japanese-Canadian example, again, when you look at the decision not to intern individuals who were suspected of being disloyal to Canada, but rather the entire community, and this our book opens with some of these stories, the really poignant taking of homes when children remember having the RCMP show up and their parents packing their luggage and leaving their farms or leaving their apartments. And this extended all the way to, you know, the emptying of hospitals in Vancouver. So you had the very elderly, the infirm, were being taken out of their secure places of care and subject to internment. So
taken over the Rockies?
East of the Rockies. So the idea that this was had even on its own terms some kind of security rationale is very hard to square with the evidence of what took place.
Yeah. On the alternatives, I wanted to just touch one of the documents that Eric and I write about when we're talking about alternatives is a proposal very early in the war to in the Pacific War to enlist Japanese Canadians in the Canadian military. And this goes very high up the chain. It comes to cabinet. Where people, one of the things that's striking about the discussion is it uses a lot of the same ideas that we might think would make the uprooting and internment inevitable. So officials are saying, we're at war now in the Pacific. Citizens on the West Coast will be concerned. People of Japanese descent have been separate from the rest of the population. People are concerned about young men, young Japanese Canadian men may be agents of the Japanese Empire. So what we should do is allow them to enlist in the Canadian military. Because then Canadians could feel assured that military-aged Japanese-Canadian men are serving the country.
They'd be watched.
And within military discipline and could understand Japanese-Canadians as contributing to our war effort. And there's language benefits and other. So there's a very viable proposal that goes to a very high level that, if accepted, sets the trajectory, I think, of the treatment of Japanese-Canadians on a totally different course. And repeatedly, In the course of the conflict, in the course of the 1940s, officials encountered those alternatives and make choices among options.
Bad choices. By the way, isn't that sort of ideologically driven in the sense that if you hand Mackenzie King the job of telling the people this is what we're going to do, he's afraid because they have a war fervor and a racial hatred. Your book documents, and it shakes people up to read it, how the homes were looted. You know, basically, people were sicked on the community in the sense of, okay, they're gone, take their house. You have a photograph of a woman who's taken over a store, and she said, white run. White, she put on that store. So King, having started a fire, is afraid of the fire. And so better they suffer than him. He's afraid to sell a good idea, right?
Well, I think no.
No, okay, go ahead.
I think no, in that there's a, you know, one of the things that happens, getting back to just what we were discussing with the memory of the 1940s. One of the things that happens, I think, is a collapse of the 1940s into a sort of single moment after the attacks on Pearl Harbor and Hong Kong, a moment of panic where the prime minister is afraid. And there's concern about what war might come to the West Coast. A year later, say around the decision to sell property of Japanese Canadians, if you look at the diaries of the prime minister at that time, he's not musing anymore about, he's not, you know, writing notes of fear about war on the West Coast. He's musing about whether, how many years he'd have to remain in office to be the longest serving prime minister in Canadian history.
Yeah.
By 40.
Thank goodness for his diary, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah.
I mean, he said about the bomb, Hiroshima, he said, well, it's a good thing they dropped it on Asians because they did that to Europeans, it'd be hell to pay.
So you see these very different moments in the course of the 40s. So 43 already is not December 41. 44 is when most of the property is sold. The Allies know they're winning. It's a matter of when. 45, by the time they decide to expel Japanese Canadians in the fall of 45, the war is over. So many of these decisions are not taken in the context of fear or war fervor. Mm-hmm. They're decisions that emerge from different places within government and society. Sometimes it's dealing with a bureaucratic problem. In the case of the end of the camps, the government has to decide what to do about thousands of Japanese Canadians in sites of internment. And there's no popular fervor demanding that they be sent to Japan.
Yeah, and by the way, I should make it clear. We're speaking to Eric M. Adams and Jordan Stanger Ross, and the book is Challenging Exile, Japanese Canadians in the Wartime Constitution. Constitution makes you laugh when you read that, wartime constitution. You're describing the winding down of the war. So they saw an opportunity for a rearrangement of the demographics of the West Coast.
I think that's right.
That's pretty ugly. A wonderful community that is doing so much to help us. It's a mutually supportive, you know, fishing and healthy economy. And by the way, as you point out in the book, King said these guys haven't broken any laws.
Yeah.
We haven't found any of these people that we're all fantasizing about. But nonetheless, well, here's our chance. These people, what's the word? Unassimilable.
Yeah. And the political calculation of politicians was always about what policy is going to get us votes to some extent in this region of Canada, and that was a preoccupation of King as well, is how do we hold on to liberal support in the West? And again, the internal documents that we look at have some really unvarnished opinions that say, we know that this is discrimination. You know, government itself saying, we know that we're not treating this community fairly. We recognize that. Yeah. But, they say, but our constituents in BC demand it, and what are we supposed to do?
Yeah. I want to ask you, what are we supposed to do, and how they did it. Somebody, well, to put it another way, lawyers, there's a joke about lawyers, that they're masters of getting around the law. And the king and his associates were brilliantly equivocal. And they could say two things at once. And could you explain how, I call it a trick, just to simplify from my thinking, that they said, sign, make a choice, east of the Rockies or Japan. And the war is still on while they sign this, and people understand it's winding down. And so they say, well, you're not going home. You're not going to go. You will not go to back to BC. So east of the Rockies or Japan. Could you? And how they turned that into, well, they wanted to go to Japan.
I'm going to let Jordan tell the story of what we call Signing Day, which is a chapter.
Wonderful chapter in the book.
And also, when we looked at this history, Jordan and I did not find many references to this really momentous moment that Japanese Canadians called Signing Day. I'll let Jordan take it away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a history that we didn't know when we started the research, really, where an official of the Department of Labor came around to the camps with the job of getting as many Japanese Canadians to sign forms accepting expulsion to Japan as possible, with the idea being as a kind of a compromise within government that if enough Japanese Canadians were sent to Japan, the rest could be permitted to live in Canada free of racist restriction on voting, employment,
east of the Rockies.
East of the Rockies, and maybe eventually, I think some of those officials, some of the people who get behind this approach would have thought of themselves as anti-racist. Mm-hmm. And so they accept this idea. But the first job, though, in that process is to get as many to sign to go to Japan as possible. So this official of the Department of Labor, a man by the name of Thomas Piggerskill, goes camp by camp to inform Japanese Canadians about the choice that they face, and basically says to them, you can go to completely uncertain lives in Eastern Canada. We don't know if you'll be able to access employment. We can't say whether you'll be able to own a home. We won't commit that your children will be able to go to school. But go now east or sign this form and you can stay where you are. A week after he comes through, more or less, RCMP officials follow with these forms. And Japanese Canadians are asking, you know, just asking what the future holds for them, right? Yeah. And so if they sign, they can remain in the camps where they are. They can keep the jobs that they found to support their families. They retain the communities that they had established in the camps. And so under those circumstances of uncertainty, approximately two-thirds in British Columbia sign. And in some of the camps, as many as 80, 90% sign. RCMP comes through. In a single day, they'll process hundreds of thousands, or hundreds and even thousands, over 1,000 people in a single day. They'll set up a desk. Japanese Canadians form a line. They come. RCMP official presents them with a form. They sign, next. And it's a moment of confusion and despair. And many Japanese Canadians sign with the understanding that they'll be able to rescind those signatures at a later date. And then
I just want to impress on this moment is incredibly coercive.
And it's only a moment.
And the Canadian government designed it for that purpose. And we have the records that show that. And they're excited when the numbers get as high as possible. It exceeds their highest hopes. And they create the uncertainty that they know will drive people into the hands of exile by most importantly saying to a people whose lives and community had already been disrupted, by the way, if you don't sign this form tomorrow, the day after that, you've got to leave, and you're going to some town in Ontario that you've never heard of. You have no idea where you'll live or what you'll do, but that's what happens to you if you refuse to sign.
Yes.
Japanese Canadians look at each other, the families write letters to one another and say, I think we better sign this thing. This is the only hope for stability. It's amazing to think that the hope, the choice for stability was to sign a form that said, after the war is over, we're going to be exiled to Japan. But that was the more stable, conservative choice for families whose lives had been disrupted.
Then it turned into, well, you signed it, you're going.
Yeah.
When the war ended, and they said, well, the war is over, and I want a chance to change. And they said, no, you signed this. And by the way, signing it meant you're disloyal.
Correct.
Am I right?
That was the premise.
You signed that. You want to be in Japan.
The premise of the legal argument.
You're an enemy.
The premise of the legal argument, which is really hard to read, is lawyers standing up and saying, this was a sign of disloyalty. And the last thing that Canada can tolerate is disloyal citizens who have no attachment to Canada being in our midst. Yes. And so the exile story of this book ends with the government of Canada trying to compel all of those signees into exiling through law.
And they went. They put them on a U.S. U.S. ship.
More than 3,000 do end up being exiled. But it's also a story of how Japanese Canadians fought against that. And they fought against it in court.
And Andy Bruin.
And they fought against it.
I hadn't heard his name in years. And I look and I say, my gosh.
Yeah.
Now I want to shake his hand and it's too late.
Yeah. He's a Torontonian and he was one of the lawyers who made the argument that this was against our Constitution. And as Jordan said earlier, the press and Canadian, I think, public society began to change their ideas about what was fair, too.
You know, they were under the shadow. They were in San Francisco writing the new charter of the United Nations saying you can't discriminate by sex and religion, language. We're all human. We have human rights.
Yeah.
At the time they're doing this. Quickly, I mean, we're coming to the end. By the way, we're speaking to Eric M. Adams and Jordan Stanger Ross, and the book is Challenging Exile, Japanese Canadians and the Wartime Constitution, which is, I guess, a joke in its head. Wartime Constitution. The deviation, I was shocked, surprised. FDR and King were together on everything. But FDR, '44, said, okay, the danger is over. The Pacific coast is secure. And the Japanese Americans can return to their homes.
It's a different history.
How did they differ so widely? You would have thought that King would have picked up the phone or Franklin would have said, no. As a matter of fact, in your book, an American did advise them not to do this.
There are overlaps, of course, in the American history and in the Canadian experience. But the Canadian experience is distinct in a number of ways. The dispossession of property is distinct, and the legal outcome of these cases is distinct. So the American U.S. Supreme Court rules differently, as you might find out if you read the book, than the Supreme Court.
Please read the book. By the way, there's a magic word, a couple of them. Habeas corpus is an ancient term, but boy, your book emphasizes why people have to understand what that is. Bring me in front of a magistrate and show me what it is, on what basis you're denying me my rights.
And it's back in the news. So there's, what's the old expression? History doesn't repeat, but sometimes it rhymes.
Yeah, it doesn't have a nice rhyme to it. It's an odd sound. Eric M. Adams and Jordan Stanger Ross, I'm very glad you're here. Challenging Exile. It's in the bookstores. Are you speaking in town?
There's an event tonight run by the Osgood Society for Legal History. So if people Google that, they can get details about the book launch this evening.
This evening?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
It's a downtown Toronto near the Eaton Center.
Okay. Well, please, everyone, if you can, attend the talk, but definitely get the book or you're not a real Canadian. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and Pedro the Magician and Technician is signing us off.